staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you a jolly, merry, happy, joyful, fantastic, exciting, fancy, magnificent, remarkable, special, white, sparkling, terrific, stunning, festive, and wonderful holiday season.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, sleeping and dreaming, essential and mysterious.
Fundamentally, sleep is by the brain and for the brain. Brains rewire at night. Our neurochemistry changes dramatically, and connections are formed in the brain to optimize function for the following day.
An old Tanzanian friend speaks about heavy rains and village celebrations.
Oh, in the village we have traditional dances. We have trumpets, we have traditional drums, we have guitars. After the harvest, we normally get together to celebrate, to eat, to drink together. People tell stories. Of course, we don't have books in the villages, but we have old people who give stories.
And in the Dutch city of Delft, a big university goes geothermal.
Yeah, so we're drilling now 2.1 kilometers and retrieve hot water. There is heat exchangers at surface. So we take out the heat. With the heat, we want to heat the campus buildings of the university, and outside 5,000 to 10,000 houses of the city of Delft will be heated with that.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Before diving in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. Few things in life are more precious than a good night's sleep. 6 or 7 hours of shut-eye, punctuated by brief visits to the loo, better yet, sleep filled with pleasant dreams. Drifting off in the middle of an important meeting or behind the wheel of your car is an entirely different story. This past week, scientists reported that nesting chinstrap penguins nod off for a few seconds 10,000 times every day, all the better to keep an eye on their nestlings. I spoke about this most cherished and mysterious activities with Brian Murray. Murray is a sleep neurologist at Sunnybrook Hospital and Research Institute in Toronto.
Sleep is a behavior, a reversible disengagement from an unresponsiveness to the environment. And you lie down and you're quiet and your eyes are closed. That's how we can quantify sleep in animals. In humans, sleep plays many roles. Some of these roles are fundamental to sleep, and others nature has tacked on as a bonus. So fundamentally, sleep is by the brain and for the brain. Brains rewire at night. Our neurochemistry changes dramatically, and connections are formed in the brain to optimize function for the following day. Along with that function, other biological processes benefit. Many systems in the body benefit from sleep. For example, our endocrine system, our immune system. So the fundamental role of sleep is for the brain, but many other health systems benefit.
And why does the brain need that?
Well, the leading thought about what happens in sleep is that over the course of the day, our brains form many new connections. We learn many new things. We acquire new knowledge. The brain has a limited capacity. There are only so many neurons that can connect in so many ways. We only have so much energy to do so. So over sleep, something has to give. And so less important or less relevant material gets washed away. And then the relatively important stuff stays connected.
And sometimes things actually get washed away literally by the cerebrospinal fluid. There's an exchange?
There isn't really a formal lymphatic system in the brain, a place to clear waste material. But in the brain, there is a space called the glymphatic space. It's a potential space in between the glia, the supporting cells in the brain and blood vessels. And at night, the space opens up dramatically and opens up a space that can clear away toxic debris. So the animal models have shown, for example, that if you keep animals with a particular mutation awake, they accumulate amyloid, the neuropeptide responsible for Alzheimer's disease. If you stay awake long enough, you just fill up with this debris. If you sleep, then there's a clearing of this material in animal models. We think probably similar kinds of things occur in humans.
So getting back to the rewiring of the brain, I've read that that sleep is kind of like a model for cortical plasticity, that the cortex is plastic and we're interested in this plasticity, but in sleep we're actually seeing plasticity in action. Can you describe it?
Absolutely. So the brain is a plastic organ. It adapts and changes, and much of this adaptation occurs through sleep. A number of neuropsychological studies support this. For example, if you stay awake practicing a visual, spatial, perceptual task, you get a little bit better. But if you take a nap and you get sleep, all of a sudden you get way better. Other studies have shown that if you, you know, practice a movement, such as learning an adapted movement that might be important in, say, rehabilitation, and you practice this movement over and over, that part of your brain actually sleeps more. The area of the brain that subsumes that activity. And so we see more intense deep sleep in that region of the brain, and that correlates with the improved function the next day.
What makes a person actually fall asleep? What triggers sleep? What happens at that moment when suddenly you start to feel sleepy and then you fall asleep?
Well, there are a number of chemical changes in the brain that occur with sleep that follow a circadian cycle, a time of day, light, dark cycle. There are a number of changes that occur in each of the different stages. So as you enter non-REM sleep, your body starts to reduce the amount of acetylcholine and the amount of adrenergic neurotransmitters in the brain.
These are the chemicals that enable neurons to communicate with each other.
Right. And then in REM sleep, all of a sudden, the cholinergic tone is very high and the aminergic tone is low. And so we see these differences that cycle. In humans, we have a 90-minute non-REM cycle that repeats 4 or 5 times throughout the night. The state is also controlled by an important neuropeptide called orexin, which is a stabilizing neuropeptide. So it helps keep you in one state or in another. Patients with narcolepsy, for example, they don't have orexin signaling, so they transition between states rapidly. So they're awake, and then they become very sleepy. Or in some situations, they may be partially awake and partially asleep. So that's the basic neurochemistry of sleep.
What is it that triggers it? Like when you're lying there, you're awake, and then you're relaxed. Let's suppose that you're a good sleeper, and then mm-hmm. at a certain point, you start to get drowsy, and then you're gone.
Well, that flip-flop switch has flipped. So, you know, really, each of these states in and of themselves are great where they are. The problem is where we have transitions, and orexin is one of the key neuropeptides that helps stabilize a state. So when orexin starts to fall, then we start to see these unusual transitions into different states. The genes of circadian rhythms are another important facet of sleep-wake control.
Tell me about that. What role do genes play, a person's genetics play in the ability to sleep or the inability to sleep?
The genes that control sleep-wake behaviors are highly conserved evolutionarily. The fruit fly has light-dark cycle sensitivity. All through biology, we see examples of things that respect a light-dark cycle. So it's obviously fundamentally very important to our being.
That when the sun goes down, things get dark, it's time to fall asleep.
Right. Except for nocturnal animals, where it's reversed. But that has some evolutionary advantage to them. But in humans, you know, the remarkable thing is we have a number of clock genes. Every cell in our body has a little molecular clock that spins around a 24-hour cycle, which is really quite remarkable to think about. Like your liver cell in a dish will have a 24-hour cycle that starts to peter out after some days, but it's entrained by the brain. So the light enters the brain through a path called the retinohypothalamic tract. So the light comes in and trains the brain state, and then that signal is transmitted to all the other cells in our body to maintain this 24-hour cycle. So if you don't have the light input, other systems can take over. For example, in blind individuals, the timing of feeding can help entrain a circadian rhythm, a time-of-day rhythm. But in general, if you've got light entering the brain, that is the most dominant reset of the cycle. But the really amazing thing is that given the number of clock genes that we have, very small genetic mutations can create significant behavioral impact. So about 15 years ago, the first report of a genetic variation in one of the clock genes was associated with a human sleep disorder. So there's a condition called human advanced sleep phase syndrome, where people tend to go to bed much earlier. And there are examples of this. You look in families, there are night owls and morning larks, and it tends to run genetically. And in this one example, they identified that a single codon mutation, the tiniest bit of genetic information flipped, could shift somebody's social structure 4 hours. So the timing of their preferred activities, when they like to get up and go to bed, when their biological rhythms manifest various hormones. A remarkably complex impact from a single codon. Remarkable to consider that such a complex behavior could be determined so simply.
Within a gene that's expressed in lots of different tissues around the body.
Yes.
And how about dreaming? What's dreaming all about? I'd like you to go into this idea that you can actually hear in your lab, you can actually observe the electrical patterns associated with dreaming. Presumably, one can actually stimulate dreaming.
Yes. So we really don't know at this point what the function of REM sleep is. A number of physiologic things happen. You're essentially paralyzed, so you don't enact your dreams. That's a good thing. But there's a condition where humans actually do enact dreams. And it can be a warning sign for neurodegenerative conditions in the brain.
So in other words, while they're dreaming, they're problem. Walking around and doing things.
They can. So normally we're paralyzed. We have rapid eye movements. You can observe that. Breathing tends to be irregular. So conditions like sleep apnea tend to get worse in REM sleep.
And REM sleep is when you're dreaming.
Yes. Although you can dream in non-REM sleep as well. The types of dreams that you have in non-REM or REM are very different, though. In REM sleep, your frontal cortex is relatively deactivated, so there's no sensor there, so the lapses in logic in a dream just seem appropriate at that state. On the other hand, we also get vivid, colorful images, lots of movement, so associative areas of the cortex, which associate with say a vision with movement or other senses, is very active. So the dreams are illogical, colorful, they're associated with intense emotion. The limbic system of the brain is very active in REM sleep.
The emotional brain.
That's right. On the other hand, in non-REM, if you wake people up out of non-REM, sometimes they report repetitive thoughts or ideas. They're not the dreams that we typically think of as being dreams, but sometimes there's kind of a repetitive thought or idea or concern that pops into the mind. And so there is a type of dreaming that occurs in non-REM sleep as well, but it's different.
And lucid dreaming.
Lucid dreaming is interesting. It's an in-between state where people can feel like they're controlling their dreams. So people can report an epic dream where they're doing something for a prolonged period of time, and they can kind of change the direction of where the dream is going or where they're physically going.
So they're
in their mind.
They say, when I was a kid, I would occasionally have dreams where I'd be extremely outrageous in the class and the teacher was going to punish me, but I knew that I was dreaming.
Right.
And I'd wake myself up and it would make me feel really happy that I could tweak the nose of the teacher because I was just dreaming.
Yeah, lucid dreaming is an interesting state of partial transition between REM sleep and wakefulness. So I mentioned before this neuropeptide orexin helps stabilize state. So Normally, when we're in REM sleep, we're paralyzed and our breathing's irregular and our limbic system's active. When we're awake, we move around, our eyes are open. Sometimes those individual fibers in the brain, subsisting each of those functions, don't coordinate themselves and they don't work together. So when orexin's not present, we get partial states somewhere in between, and that can lead to problems. Lucid dreaming can be seen in patients with narcolepsy, for example, who are lacking orexin. But even normal people without narcolepsy who are, you know, severely sleep deprived can get themselves into a state where they're prone to these rapid transitions between states, incomplete rapid transitions.
I mean, this is like the age-old question. Does dreaming have a purpose or a significance? Or is it just an artifact, as it were, of just strange rewiring patterns and just happens to, strange phenomena that happens, it has no purpose or objective, if you will.
So sleep itself is fundamentally important for the brain, but what actually happens in REM sleep, what the purpose or reason for that is not clear. It does seem to be a biological artifact, but we really don't know.
So dreaming would appear to be a biological artifact, you're
saying? I think so.
It's kind of disappointing for people who like to interpret their dreams.
Yeah, well, it's interesting.
They have a little notebook by the table, the bed table, and they're journaling their dreams.
Well, the contents of the dream do reflect some things that occur in the day. So oftentimes, you know, if something's been occurring frequently, you know, a lot of the cortex is busy processing that information, so that content may come out in the dream state. But what the dream itself means, who knows? I think it's probably an artifact of that information without the frontal lobes there to kind of walk through it in a logical manner.
Insomnia. You can't fall asleep. I can't fall asleep at night. I actually have difficulty falling asleep at night, but it's very common.
Yeah.
What are the causes of insomnia?
So insomnia is a really common condition. It's one of the top 10 presenting reasons to see a family physician. And sometimes it's transient, it's related to a stressful event. Other times it's chronic. When it's chronic, we need to make sure that there isn't an underlying medical reason for it. Conditions such as the restless leg syndrome can interfere with sleep onset and produce insomnia. So that's a common contributor to that, that's not always identified. Behavioral factors contribute far more commonly to sleep initiation troubles. So, for example, eating too close to bedtime, not having a dark, quiet room, not keeping a routine.
Too much screen time.
Screen time. So light activates the retinal hypothalamic tract in the brain. So if you're, you know, looking at a light source, a computer screen up close, close to bedtime, it's sending a signal to your brain to wake up, the opposite of what you want at bedtime. So those are some of the many behavioral factors. Caffeine, for example, another thing. Alcohol. Alcohol can fool you because it will hasten sleep onset, but the sleep that follows is often very fragmented and discontinuous. And probably a lot of that has to do with triggering sleep disordered breathing. So alcohol relaxes the upper airway, and people snore more, and then they're more prone to wake up from these respiratory events.
So sleep fragmentation and insomnia in general are not good for your health, generally speaking.
Well, there have been studies looking at sleep fragmentation predicting worse cognitive outcome over a period of time. Certainly sleep disorders can fragment sleep and create trouble. Somebody with sleep apnea and a low blood oxygen to the brain is going to create problems. In and of itself, the sleep fragmentation is probably significant, but research in this is hard to do. You have to study people over long periods of time and have ways of quantifying the sleep effects on the brain function, each and of themselves difficult measurement problems, but you know, the information continues to accrue. It makes sense. It's biologically, it seems somewhat obvious. I mean, you know, sleep has got to be important for your health. Why would we spend a third of our lives doing it otherwise?
Brian Murray is a sleep neurologist at Sunnybrook Hospital and Research Institute in Toronto. Read more about his research interests and sleep at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Salaam, Tanzania's largest city and Africa's fourth largest port on the edge of the Indian Ocean, is a funky town. Under the dual influence of El Nino originating in the Pacific and the Indian Ocean dipole, Dar has been experiencing heavy rains and flooding these days. Stuck in your car or packed into a dollar-dollar minibus on a muddy road, getting from one side of Dar to another is always a challenge. No one knows more about this than one of the Green Planet Monitor's oldest friends, Josephat Mwanzi. I reached Josephat at home on the edge of Tanzania's City of Peace. So, Josephat, you work in Dar es Salaam, if I'm correct, but you live outside Dar es Salaam. Can you tell me where it is that you do work in Dar es Salaam, right?
Yes, I work in Dar es Salaam. And I live in Dar es Salaam too. So this is the city that I have been living in for more than 15 years now.
But you were telling me yesterday, we were trying to connect yesterday, and you had been at work and you were going home, and you were telling me that the traffic is terrible and it was going to take you a long time to get home. And I know the roads are really challenging. Can you tell me what the situation is in Dar es Salaam, like going back and forth between where you work and where you live? And there are rains. It's very rainy at the moment.
Yes, it is very rainy. And I would say, Dave, that we have unusual rains at the moment. You know, Dar es Salaam is the largest city in Tanzania. And it is the most famous city in East Africa and the Central Africa for it is a business city that provides services, business services to many countries around Tanzania. It is because of its geographical location that it is along the shores of Indian Ocean. And it is located on the coast. So in the area with the two rain seasons, and it is hot and humid sometimes, almost all the year around, with all slightly hotter and wetter period from November to April. That's the normal situation or the normal weather. But during the rain seasons, it is more reliable here to receive normal rains and life goes on. But this time, Dar es Salaam is very vulnerable, I would say, because we have heavy rains since October. We have been receiving heavy, heavy rains. And they come with windy. It is so windy. And it has caused a lot of damage. So yesterday, I had planned to talk with you to have this conversation to be held yesterday, but I could not make it. It is because it was raining heavily in Dar es Salaam, and the rain came unexpectedly because in the morning it was... the weather was favorable. It was good and it was sunny. But from 13 p.m., the weather started changing and it rained heavily. Now, when it rains in Dar es Salaam, it always is a challenge because the rain causes a lot of traffic jam. Cars, especially here, we have what we call a daradara, the small buses, that is used by the public. It is a public transport means. So when it rains, the daladalas, these small buses, cause they face a lot of traffic jam because we have some small roads that these buses sometimes want to use as shortcuts to town or away from the city. But when it rains, almost all cars tend to use the main roads. And this is because the main roads are safer because they are tarmac. They are good.
Because the other roads, the smaller roads that the daladalas take, are not paved. They've got potholes that are so deep you can disappear into them.
Exactly. And some cars can get into muddy and they cannot even move out of it. That's the challenge. So as more cars come to use the main roads, the more traffic jams we have experienced. So that's what happened to me yesterday. From the city center to my place where I live, it is supposed to be almost 1 or 2 hours. It takes me more about 2 hours to reach my place. But yesterday it was more than 6 hours.
And I mean, you said that you live inside Dar es Salaam, and it takes you an hour and a half to drive from work in downtown Dar es Salaam to home?
Yes, where I live, and it is where I'm talking with you from now, it's my place here. It is about 30 kilometers away from the city center. So yeah, I am I'm in the suburb of the center. I'm not away of the city center. So, and I am, my district or my province is within the center. So can imagine if I am within the surroundings of the city center, then something like that happens to me. So it is even worse to those who are outside the center.
So, Josephat, is the impression that these rains that are falling, that you were saying that they've started early? Normally they start in November, but they started earlier, and the winds are very strong. Is this because of climate change?
According to the TMA is what we call Tanzania Meteorological Authority, which is the legal authority in Tanzania to predict weather, to give information about and climate issues. They say that the current rains directly connected to El Nino influences, and that has caused these rains to come in that situation that we've experienced now. And many experts say that this is an impact of climate change. And they conclude that these rains are related to climate change because of the unpredictable patterns that come along with these rains.
And are these heavy rains causing damage to homes and causing problems with food production, agriculture?
They have caused the impact to, I would say, mainly two levels. One is the human impact to human people, people's lives. Then there is an impact that goes to the, what I would say, things, to the infrastructure, say, something like that, roads. So on the human lives, direct human lives, you find that these rains have caused some death. According to the official data, it shows that at least since October and now in November, about 5 people have died because of these rains in Dar es Salaam, but also in the near region called Lindi. Also, there have been floods and have caused some death there, though the records of the status is not issued yet. But also, it has increased the cost.